Today's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Diabolik DVD, featuring demented discs from all over the world. Check them out online at www.diabolikdvd.com. They are the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from all around the world. If you are looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head over to Diabolik DVD. Right now, over at the website, you will find all the latest releases from Severin Films, including Next of Kin, Invasion of the Blood Farmers, and Skinner. They have the new 4K restorations of Fulci's Zombie from Blue Underground. They also have the 3-disc limited edition of Maniac from Blue Underground. They also have Porno Holocaust, now available on Blu-ray for the first time ever. Again, that's Porno Holocaust. So for all of your horror and cult cinema needs, head on over to DiabolikDVD.com or find them on Facebook.
Excuse me, do you happen to have Porno Holocaust? Why, yes, we do. Tonight's Shockwaves is also brought to you by Shudder. AMC Network Shudder is a premium streaming video service, super serving fans of all degrees with the best selection of horror and thrillers. Shudder's irrepressible and thriving community revels in all things provocative, evocative, and dangerous. From bantering with Shudder on social media and contributing fantastic, irreverent reviews to relishing in member-only perks such as exclusive releases and VIP movie screenings, Shudder believes there is safety in numbers. Don't be left in the dark alone. You can stream great thrillers, horror, and suspense for $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year. Shudder has the largest, fastest-growing human-curated selection of thrilling and dangerous entertainment. I'd go further than just saying human-curated. It is curated by real horror fans and some of the best in the biz. It has been called the Netflix of horror, and it right now has The Reflecting Skin, which is a favorite of mine and super hard to get
such
up until now.
Movie.
So very happy about that. To try Shudder free for 30 days, go to Shudder.com /podcast and use promo code WAVE. That's Porno Holocaust. No, sorry.
Fangoria turns 40 this year, and issue 2 is out to subscribers now. It's 100 pages of exclusive, carefully curated horror content honoring horror's past, present, and future. Fangoria is also getting into music. Holly Doom is a collection of synthwave scores from artists like John Carpenter, Power Glove, Gunship, and more. Holly Doom is now available wherever you download music. Fango's book line continues. Joining Preston Fassel's Our Lady of the Inferno is Max Booth III's Carnivorous Lunar Activities. It's a bloody romp about the dilemma of what to do when you discover your childhood BFF is a werewolf. Relatable. Carnivorous Lunar Activities is available for pre-order. Head to Fangoria.com now to learn more and subscribe. Subscribe today and get issue 3 shipping in April. $60 gets you a year subscription and saves you about $20 off the cover price. Fangoria.com.
Okay, and welcome to episode 135 of Shockwaves. The whole gang is back.
Ah, you blew it.
We're
going to pretend
that
we're going to greenlight more movies.
Oh, no.
The Greenlight Show. That's what our spinoff could be.
All right. Well, that's I'm Rob Galuzzo. That's Elric Kane.
That's me.
That was fun last week. Huh? Yeah.
That part was fun. Our Letterboxd controversial conversation has sparked a lot of internet trolls.
I've got more Letterboxd followers now in the last week.
Actually, you're right. I did too, but a lot of them are mad at me.
Yeah, as I am too.
Because of how I reviewed Microwave Massacre.
Ryan Turek is back.
I got crabs by watching Porno Holocaust, guys.
Wow.
Crabs.
How did you watch
movie,
it?
Well, it does have crabs in the movie, actual crabs.
There are
it's
actual
on a
crabs.
Beach.
I have a bad feeling that rumor is going to get out now, dude.
That's Rebecca McKendry's here.
Yeah, that movie is
what
neither.
What did that movie do to you?
It's neither sexy nor scary. I'm a little confused by it, but it's still something. It's like you can't stop watching it, but at the same time, you're like, I don't get it.
It's a little bushy.
It's a little bushy.
The takeaway, if you stop listening now, is that Ryan has crabs. then you can just stop listening. It really doesn't matter how he got them.
And that's our horror podcast for you. Oh, and apparently we're on live right now, so you can go back and look at our live.
Why don't we put it over there?
We're going to make us live for a second.
I know. Now I'm blocked by the massive turret head.
Oh. All right.
Well,
let's see. What updates do we need to do? Hey, I don't know if we've mentioned it yet, but I think all of us, we're still working on the details, but we should all be at Chattanooga Film Festival this year.
I believe so. It looks like we are all going.
I've never been, so I'm excited.
You were a little inebriated.
You vomited on us.
There was vomit.
I remember Knoxville. I went to Knoxville. Chattanooga?
No, you definitely like...
There's a long thread about your exploits.
I remember Joe Bob. Was that Joe Bob?
Yes, Joe Bob was there, yes.
But we're going to be at Chattanooga.
Yeah, we'll be at Chattanooga, and it also looks like we're going to be at Texas Frightmare again this year.
Texas Frightmare.
So that's very exciting.
And Salem Horror Fest.
Salem Horror Fest.
Look at this.
Oh my God, guys. Hopefully.
Shockwaves
tour. It's like Shockwaves on the road.
Anything more than 4 months away, it's always a hopeful.
I know.
Well, that's the tour schedule coming up. But Chattanooga should be fun. It'll be our second year there, and that's in April 11th to the 14th. The only bummer is it's the same weekend as Monsterpalooza, so this will be the first time I'm missing Monsterpalooza here in
Los Angeles. Go to some Monsterpalooza.
Yeah.
I will. I go to all of them.
Wow, that's very defensive.
Yes. He goes to all of them, Elric. Uh-oh. So, yeah, I'm totally excited to head back to Chattanooga. Yeah.
3 stars is a good review. This is why I'm defensive.
See, I agree with Rob on that. I think you are being way too hard.
No, here's the thing about 3 stars is you won't probably rewatch a 3-star movie.
I might. Disagree.
You might.
I might.
That's the whole key word.
I might
there.
Not. Exactly. What do you care?
I care because you gave Ritual 3 stars.
Look, I don't just give out my 4 stars to anybody.
No,
I will say
that. You got to hold that back for someone you care about. Come on. Hold that 4 stars.
Wow.
You got to mean it.
Oh, man. Well, we've all seen stuff, but let's get into stuff. Okay. All right. We'll get to our topic at the end then.
Yeah.
Let's see. Let me kick us off then. There was a film – the one thing I love about – and it's just, you know, Los Angeles is big for this because we have a lot of repertoire theaters and stuff like that. But just independent theaters is getting the opportunity to see stuff that you just can't see any other way, mm-hmm. that just didn't get put out on DVD, whatever the case is. This is the first time I attended the Autry Museum, which normally shows – they got a little theater, the Wells Fargo Theater, and they show – I don't know. It's like 200 seats maybe.
It's adorable. Seats. It's a really
great
theater.
It's a cool little venue, and it's connected to the to the museum there and all that
near the zoo.
Yeah, right near the Griffith Park Zoo and all. And so anyways, so my buddy Scott Reynolds, who is a friend of the show, he's been on, he goes to see a lot of movies there. He invited me to see Curse of the Undead from 1959, which is the first ever vampire western. I'd never heard of this film. It's got an amazing poster. And so I went in blindly because I was like, oh, this sounds pretty cool. And it was cool.
It's like Black Sabbath.
Yeah, the poster is very similar to Black Sabbath, Bob is. But this was a really pleasant surprise. And a lot of interesting history behind it because this was 59, it was kind of the tail end. This kind of falls under the Universal Monsters kind of bracket in terms of everything they did. And it's considered the second to last Universal horror movie of that era. The last one was right after this called Leech Woman, I think.
Yep.
I rather enjoy Leech Woman.
Yeah, so that was right after this. And basically...
That is a good poster.
Yeah, it's
that
a great poster.
That is a really good poster. Yeah. Wow.
Basically, it's a low-budget Western thriller. The first... It kind of starts out as... in the opening, basically, there's a sick girl in town, and she ends up dying abruptly. The only thing we know is that she's got 2 little holes in her neck. And obviously, we're like, oh, it's obviously a vampire feeding on these young girls. But... the doctors can't figure it out. They're like, oh, there's some sort of plague or something going on. And then that dovetails right into kind of, traditional Western idea of two neighbors' families kind of competing for what part of the land is theirs, et cetera. Like one's trying to muscle the other one out of what's rightfully their land. And that starts this big – basically it starts a revenge story because the vampire feeds on the father. They assume that it's the neighbor who killed him to try to get the land. Mm. So for the whole first act, you're just kind of going through this he said, she said thing between these two families, kind of a whole Hatfield-McCoy thing, only not as intense. And then this mysterious guy who just rolls into town, he kind of looked – his name is Michael – Pate. He's got a great look to him.
Wow.
He reminds me of that guy, Richard Brake from Rob Zombie's like 31.
Yeah.
He looks like that, but like, you know, Western style. And basically he is
it's like if Fred Gwynne and Richard Brake had a baby.
Yeah, which is
kind of
crazy.
And he dressed like Johnny Cash. Yeah,
no, he's cool. So basically he's just kind of this drifter in town. We all know he's the vampire. But what's interesting is he just kind of lays back and lets everybody do their thing. He only makes himself presentable when – so basically the wife of the guy – I'm sorry, the daughter of the guy that got murdered now puts up signs to basically kill the next door neighbor. She's like, I'm putting a bounty on his head. Mm. And he's responsible for all of it. So that's when he shows up and he's like, I'll kill this man for what you're offering. And then you go into his whole backstory and then literally the last half of it – kind of has got that cool universal gothic vibe to it.
Ooh.
Like it's interesting.
That's cool.
Never been released. I think the last release it got other than theatrical was VHS. Mm. It's never been available otherwise. This was a pristine print. I don't know where they got it from, but I think they showed it in 35 and it looked amazing.
Why does it look daylight?
That's the thing. He's out in the daylight. Yeah. Whoa. There's what's cool about it is for the most part, because this was literally when Hammer was just starting their kind of remake cycle of the Universal Monster movies. So the rules weren't 100% there yet. He does talk about an impending sun allergy. Hmm. So I think it's just he's used to it, but he just can't handle it for too long.
Mm-hmm.
And what's cool about it is they actually do introduce one or two really interesting vampire things that I had never seen. Like, I've seen them, but this is the movie that did it first, but nobody knows because basically this thing has been lost.
Does anyone say Got Wood Preacher?
Yeah.
It's a direct – hey, that would be a good double feature though.
Yeah.
Little vampires in there.
Yeah.
See that?
This one is terrific. It's called Curse of the Undead. I really don't know how else to find it. It's just one of those rare movies. I would love if somebody would find it and put it out again, like a Kino Lorber type. I'm sure there's probably a YouTube version, but I wouldn't recommend watching it that way. Mm. And unfortunately, the original negative burned up in that big Universal fire like 10 years ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, they had a copy of it there and it's gone. So yeah, I mean, if somebody out there's listening that. Works for one of these labels, you should absolutely contact the Autry and get this print because this is a gem. This was a really great movie.
Wow.
Yeah, Curse of the Undead.
Nice.
Elric.
Me? I've never gone the reverse.
We always go in this direction.
Always. And we have this conversation every week,
guys,
too.
We just need to get around to the fact that Elric is a little senile.
I thought we go reverse.
He's getting
clockwise.
Older.
I mean,
speaking that wouldn't
whispers.
Be reverse clockwise. That still would not be correct.
We need to use cue cards for Elric now.
Wait, that would be reverse clockwise.
Do we need to get him one of those hummingbird like hearing?
I'm going
to
get him a life alert.
Good. I think.
Hold on, I
want to
turn off the lights. All right, the clapper. I saw one of the most boldly, distinctly original films I've seen in a long time, Possession of Hannah Grace. This is a film that I think would redefine possession movies or exorcism movies?
Oh. What are you talking about?
Ryan's making a face. Nose. He's got a scrunchy face.
Well, I just smell something in here. It smells.
Smells like So this movie. I don't know. It's like watching a
trope. Were you not being serious?
No, I was not. It's like a trope that has somebody adapted a trope and not a movie and not a concept. It's like the opening scene is an exorcism scene, and instantly the bed starts rocking and coming off a thing, and the girl starts doing the arch of her back.
Uh-huh.
And it was one of those first times I've watched a movie that is doing something we see in a lot of movies, but it feels like they are just doing it. That there's not even a story. It's just basing it on the thing. Oh, yeah, now we have to do that. Now we have to do that. Now, mm-hmm. And it just – at no point did I feel any connection to anything I watched.
Yeah.
And it was so frustrating because I kind of wanted to really like it. But then
you realized the autopsy of Jane Doe occurred.
I know. And that's such a good movie. I mean, the opening of this is particularly generic, like just the opening setup scene. But then once you're in the actual space, the space is cool. The rules of the space are cool. I think the direction's fine. It's not
what space are they in?
They are in a morgue.
Yep.
I can't even talk about it. And it's not even that it's good or bad. It's just the level of being generic to the point of like, what else?
You should explain what the plot is. The plot is Shay Mitchell from Pretty Little Liars plays a mortician who was formerly a cop who had an unfortunate incident.
Some sort of mental break. Issue, yeah.
And the girl who was suffering the exorcism at the beginning of the film is now dead. Her corpse is rolled into the morgue, and Shay Mitchell's character has to just basically tend to the morgue for the night, but this corpse just won't stay down.
Well, and yeah, and the corpse moving around stuff's cool, but here's the problem with like exorcism. She's tied to a bed, right? And in the opening scene, she is able to, with her mind, levitate anyone around her and then break them in half. And I'm like, why didn't you do that 5 minutes earlier before the movie even started? She can do it anytime she wants. She can just, there are no real rules to what the, she keeps doing it to people throughout the movie. It's like, oh, they start lifting off the ground and she kills them or breaks their bodies. And I'm like, well, then she's indestructible. Yeah. The whole, I don't know. I was excited about this. This is one I actually wanted to see in theaters.
I saw it in theaters.
You did, yeah. I knew it wasn't well reviewed. And I think some people probably, I think I've already read people on our Facebook, on the Shockwaves group saying how much they enjoyed it. So so maybe it is enjoyable, not for me. But there was just something about it. Yeah, like I just want some twist on the thing itself, you know? The space was interesting because it was like a high tech security autopsy.
High tech morgue I've ever seen.
Stealing dead bodies. So anyway, this one, it just, yeah, didn't quite work for me.
Wow. The possession of
Hannah Grace.
Yeah.
Let's talk about 1985's The New Kids. Director Sean Cunningham.
Oh, wow.
James
Spader. The poster has two terrified teenagers, a bunch of masked villains behind them, and in the foreground is a bunch of rifles leveled at these teenagers. And on the poster at the top, it says, "A New Ticket to Terror" from the director of Friday the 13th.
I've never even seen this poster before.
Turek, you're on the wrong show because on Pure Cinema, this poster is on Brian's wall in his office. And we have talked about this show many. This is one of his favorites. This has gotten much love. So.
I'm not going to disparage because I genuinely enjoyed it. It is not a horror film. It's about as teen thrillery as you can get for the 80s. Basically, what you have is a terrific 10 minutes in which you meet Tom Atkins, who is a colonel who is very excited about his day because he's about to meet the president. The president's going to award him with a new medal, a Medal of Honor. He wakes his children up by, one, storming into his son's bedroom going, "What are you doing? Whacking it off in there? Come on, let's go. Let's wake up. We got things to do." And the son's like, "Ha ha, Dad." And then he storms into his daughter's bedroom and he's like, "Time to wake up, sweetie. You got to work on that sexy body of yours. Come on, let's go." And then it proceeds to have like a training montage where he's running with his kids and he's like the best dad in the world. Well, guess what? Tom Atkins and his wife in the film die, leaving these two children orphaned. The kids move to Florida to live with their uncle who has a rundown amusement park. And he is hopefully going to get this amusement park back on its feet. And he's probably going to persuade the son to use the inheritance money to work on this theme park. Meanwhile, the two kids go to their high school. They're getting acclimated. But James Spader, who has a very albino-esque look in this film, runs in a gang of preppy assholes from the 80s.
You've seen them in every film. Is he still Spader sexy?
Oh, he's like, this is primo Spader sexy.
Okay. I'll say his weird blonde, white hair or whatever.
He's got like white hair, white eyebrows. Style. He kind of reminds me of Swan's henchman from Lord of Illusions.
Yeah, a little bit.
Does he wear the shorty shorts?
No, no shorty shorts.
Damn it.
Those are in my closet.
You're never nude shorts.
So James Spader has his eyes on Lori Loughlin, who is the daughter, played by the who plays the daughter.
Look at this douche. Oh my God.
That is so like sexy Spader. Yeah. It's the aviators that
but
do it.
It's Spader playing like kind of Florida white trash, you know? And he has eyes for the daughter, and basically him and the boys create a bet to see who's going to get in her pants first. And, you know, they make their attempts, and the son, her brother, like kind of fights them off. Rob's like going through images.
And Alex laughing.
Well, because he's very intense in that.
And so what happens is when she fends off their advances, then the gang wreak havoc on the uncle's fun park, on their lives, and it starts to escalate and get deadly, and it all culminates in a siege scenario where they all have to fend off these bad guys.
There seems to be a lot of facets in this. There's a lot going on.
Oh, there's a lot going on. It's pretty cool. There are no masks in it, which is strange. There are no masks that are on the poster. So anyways, I thought this was a thoroughly enjoyable mid-80s thriller. Good performances, lots of fun. It's got a lot of heart to it. you know, it's Cunningham doing, you know, like a cool, you know what this is? This is like an HBO discovery. Like you're sitting back on like in 1987 and you're like, hey, what's this movie I've never seen with James Spader? Oh, it's The New Kids.
Yeah.
But you can find it on Amazon Prime right now. I highly recommend it. It's a lot of fun.
Cool.
The New Kids.
The New Kids.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Don't expect masks.
Well, I will jump in with one that I, since we're in the 80s, we're just going to bump forward just a few years, to I'm Dangerous Tonight, which I think both Ryan and I watched. Yeah. So this one was brought to me by Josh Miller a couple of weeks ago. He emails me and he's like, okay, so I watched this movie over the weekend. I Am Dangerous. It's going to be your bag, Becca. You need to go get this now. And this is a kind of, I won't call it lost, but we'll call it a lesser known Tobe Hooper film. Somewhat lost because I don't think it made it past VHS in the US, or if it did, like the DVD was like stupid expensive.
Yeah, I think so.
I ended up buying an import DVD of it. But yeah, I'm Dangerous Tonight. So the whole, this is from 1990, made for TV movie. The whole setup is that there is this Egyptian mummy coming into town, had some bad shit happen to it, and it is wearing this amazingly fresh-looking
red cloak.
That's satin and has little flowers on the shoulders. And this girl, played by Machen.
Machen and Mick.
Yes. Oh. By far, like, as soon as I posted about this, everybody was like, holy shit, is that Machen?
Yeah.
She is an overworked college student who has trouble saying no. And so she is. I'm like, quit walking all over Machen. So, like, her lab partner, or she's doing some type of class, and her partner is like, I can't read any of the books or write the papers. And she's like, I'll do it. And then he's like, well, I'm also in this play. Do you want to work props? And she's like, sure.
Yeah.
And then she gets home, and her aunt's like, I need you to stitch up my dresses. And she's like, sure. They're really kind of painting her as this Cinderella character. Plus, she lives with her stepmother. She lives with her
aunt and her grand, and she's basically taking care of her grandmother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so she ends up taking on all of this crap because she doesn't stand up for herself. And she is doing props for Hamlet. Or Macbeth, one of the Shakespearean plays. And she ends up happening upon this trunk at a yard sale, which has this ancient mummy cloak in it.
Yep.
And she takes
it. Mummy cloak?
It's a mummy cloak. And wow. She takes it, and it ends up in the play, and somebody gets injured, so they kick the kid out of the play, and she gets that cloak back, and she decides, why don't I make it into a prom dress like you do? So she's now made ancient mummy cloak into this absolutely ravishing red prom dress. And then from there, she wears it.
Before, you got to back that up, because the guy that she's kind of, the pseudo boyfriend, mm-hmm. she brings the cloak to a rehearsal of the play, and he puts it on him, and they're rehearsing a scene with actual swords, and they're gonna
which is very confusing.
Yeah. But once he puts the cloak on, he basically becomes incredibly aggressive, and he starts taking swipes at his co-lead, who's also got a sword, and they just start duking it out. And he, like, winds up cutting the dude up pretty bad.
Yeah, he, like, fucks his shit up. Like, he swipes both of his cheeks.
And so the cloak falls off him, and he's like, oh, what happened?
I don't even remember what I was doing.
So the cloak's got these abilities to, like, bring out more aggression in you.
Or they describe it as whatever your, like, deepest desire is. If you're evil already, it will make you more evil. If you're really sweet, whatever your deepest desire is.
Why is it a mummy thing? It just doesn't – it could have been just a haunted cloak.
Just go with it.
I have questions.
Well, the mummy came in because at the beginning of the film, you're introduced to a university professor, and
played by
Anthony Hopkins.
This wasn't Anthony Perkins. It was a different character. Okay. Anthony Perkins is a professor.
He's
a professor.
I'm
looking at the cast, and you're not mentioning any of these people.
Well, we're getting to that because he hasn't been introduced.
None of them have come in yet.
Okay. But basically, a professor comes. He's receiving a shipment for like one of the museums or something like that, and he unearths the mummy and takes out the cloak, and then the next thing you know, he's grabbing an axe and fucking taking down the security guard.
Yep.
And then somehow the cloak winds up at this fucking yard sale. But yeah, Anthony Perkins plays Machen and Mick's professor, who may or may not know about the cloak's superpowers.
Oh, he totally fucking knew. Anyway, so then after her love interest, you know, swipes another guy on stage, she ends up with the cloak. and decides to turn it into a prom dress. And then she puts it on in the first night, and she looks absolutely ravishing, goes into a party, ends up, like, making out with her best friends or her cousin's boyfriend. Yeah. And then comes to in a truck while they're about to have sex and has taken off the dress so she can have sex, and then suddenly is like, how did I get here, and why am I about to have sex with you?
And this boyfriend is, like, really quick to swallow ladies' faces.
Yes.
Like, they show him, like, getting ready to make out with her cousin. He's just like, bleh, like, gobbling her face.
And it's a quick transition because he's making out with the cousin at the dance, and the cousin leaves to go to the bathroom. Match and walks over and is like, do you want to go to your truck?
Oh, she puts on a super sexy dance.
And then he's like, yeah, let's go to my truck and have sex. Mm-hmm. And then it's just from there. Yeah. So now,
so
cousin,
they don't do it.
No, sorry. Right. She does end up in her bra. Oh,
okay. All right.
And it's a strapless because the dress is strapless. So there you go.
So you just went from 2.5 to 3. All right.
But then from
on
there.
On the Becker ratings while we're watching scale.
But then from there, it goes to, okay, so she has now realized that there may be something weird about this dress. And you don't even have to have it on. It happens if she's holding it or standing on it and just in its near proximity. But then it starts going to other people. Like, her cousin was really envious of the dress, and so her cousin steals it out of her closet and puts it on, and then crazy shit happens.
Yeah.
And so then Madchen goes, okay, well, the dress is completely fucked up. I'm going to throw it away. Or it ends up at the morgue. Somebody wears it, and it ends up at the morgue. And then the morgue technician takes it.
Played by Dee Wallace.
Yeah, played by Dee Wallace takes it.
So
there's a crackhead in it.
No, what happens is because it's the cousin. She gets into
a car wreck.
She gets into the car wreck, yeah. And her corpse is brought to the morgue.
A lot of story, Rob.
Yeah.
There's a lot of story.
Well, the dress is this is basically like a low rent in fabric.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, what happens is the cousin goes to the morgue, her corpse is there. Dee Wallace is kind of like a shady mortician. She steals.
Well, they
the dress.
Say that she's a recovering drug addict. But they're convinced, the other mortician is convinced she's still on drugs. Like, there's a whole backstory to Dee Wallace's character.
Yes, and we follow Dee Wallace for like a good chunk of the movie.
And she's in like a really shady apartment, and then she convinces some guy she's a prostitute just to kill him. I don't even know what happened there.
And I feel like that when Dee Wallace shows up and it's kind of like this sleazy mortician, that's when director Toby Hooper really starts coming out. I mean, you kind of remind yourself through the experience, like, why did Toby direct this?
So that was my biggest reaction to it. I kept looking for the Toby Hooper humor. Through the whole thing. And it didn't really happen. Like, this felt like a very standard made-for-TV horror. And it had some interesting stuff, and it was definitely had some campy moments, but not intentionally campy, until Dee Wallace showed up with her jet black hair, like, trying to kill and prostitute in the truck. And then I was like, okay, now this shit just got crazy. Yeah. It's fun. It's got a lot of fun
stuff.
Did you think
it was fun?
I did, at the end.
I like the first half.
Yeah.
It should be noted that Arlie Ermey also shows up as a detective.
Which is crazy because he chain smokes the whole time. Like, they're standing in the lunch line getting mashed potatoes, and he's got a plate of mashed potatoes and a cigar.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, I didn't think it was like kooky enough to be remarkable or memorable. Like, I'm glad I saw it because I had never heard of this film until you brought it up a couple episodes ago, and I had no idea Toby was remotely attached to this, but it's just like, what the fuck?
It's no Mangler, I will say that. Like,
they can't all be a Mangler.
That could mean a lot of things to different people.
Mike Williamson right now is getting,
like,
tingly.
Oh, so it's not a masterpiece. Somebody else is going, it's not a piece of shit.
I mean,
what a spectrum.
When I watch Toby, there's a certain level of kind of humor that I expect that, you know,
Mick Garris called the red humor.
The red humor. I agree with that. And sometimes it's hit or miss. Sometimes I watch and I'm like, oh, that's pure Toby. And then other times I'm like, that kind of fell on its face. But it's still there. This one felt like he was missing for a part of it. So it definitely felt inconsistent. But the plot was interesting. It's got this amazing cast in it. And when I posted it up online that I was watching this, I easily, within an hour, had 10 comments of, I love this movie unabashedly. It's just amazing. So it's got a big cult following to it.
Very, very weird.
I would not call this an unabashed love. I don't know if I will be watching this one again anytime soon.
So it's a 2.5 star movie.
I think I may have given it 3 for pure camp value of Dee Wallace showing up at the end.
$10 right now you gave it 2.5.
But I do
That's
like
how much my memory can work on you.
The VHS box that I have has like Anthony Perkins front and center, like, on the box. And he is just kind of like in and out. He's really good. And it's just like I have a note that says Perkins there to drop professorial wisdom.
That's it. He's almost
it.
He's literally, like, he'll show up, and it's weird because he technically does not know anything that's going on with this dress, but then he'll show up and be like, did you know that sometimes fabrics can harbor the demons of the soul? And he just says this, wow. And you're like, okay,
you
okay.
You gotta be able to deliver
that's very topical show, yeah. With everything that's going on, and then he disappears for another 20 minutes.
Oh, another note I have that may or may not titillate you. Wheelchair tug of war with grandma in the dress.
Which was hilarious.
Okay.
So grandma was the trip. And Elric, fuck you. Correct. I did give it 2.5.
See? I remember it because I don't follow
you
many people.
You stalk me on Letterboxd, don't you?
I actually don't follow many people. So I actually see what all of you are always doing things and I remember.
Wow.
I'm watching, Ryan. I don't think you're on there, are you?
I am on Letterboxd, but I don't rate.
Oh.
I don't rate just for pure political
reasons.
If I know the people, I don't rate.
Well,
yeah. I mean, like, I just stay off the rating system. I use Letterboxd as a way to track what I'm watching, and I also use it as reference. So
this episode brought to you by Letterboxd. We should get that. A good sponsor. Anyway.
All right. That's I'm Dangerous Tonight. Same year-ish. Movie I've been wanting to see forever. I don't know why I never got around to it, but I remember it on the video store shelves. I remember reading about it on Fangoria, and Vinegar Syndrome put this out, and it's called Luther the Geek.
Oh, that's a weird movie.
It's weird.
Yeah.
Now, Troma didn't make this, but Troma put it out, and so the cover art, the box art was always terrible. So I don't know if that's what turned me off it, but it's not that kind of movie at all. It's definitely a Vinegar Syndrome style movie, and basically the opening scene takes place at like a carnival in like the late 30s where a bunch of people are kind of provoking the carnival geek to bite off the head of a chicken in case you didn't know what a geek was. And so he does it, and of course they're immediately repulsed even though they, you know, enticed him to do it. But then there's a very curious little boy in the audience that suddenly becomes obsessed with, and I think he goes up and actually, I can't remember if he grabs the chicken or does whatever, but he basically becomes obsessed with being a geek. And then out of nowhere, it just cuts from 1938 to present day, whatever that is.
Oh.
And you see a mysterious character in kind of Freddy Krueger style creating these like razor sharp teeth. And it's all close-ups of it, and then he puts it in his mouth, and then the logo comes up, and it says Luther the Geek. And it's like, wow, okay, I get it. And then it cuts to a bunch of people talking in an insane asylum, because apparently that little kid, immediately after we met him, apparently killed 3 people off-screen and has been in an asylum the whole time.
Oh, okay.
And they're going to let him go. I don't know what the technicality was, but it's like, oh, no, he's fine now. He's totally cured. And so he gets out into society, and from the moment he's out, he's just so odd-looking. He doesn't talk. He just clucks like a chicken. Mm. So he goes to the supermarket, eats raw eggs. There's a little old lady sitting at the bus stop. He goes and sits next to her, puts his teeth in, bites and eats her neck out.
Oh, God.
And basically he just goes on a rampage all of a sudden. You're like, holy crap. Like, they're not wasting any time. They're doing whatever it is. And then he basically jumps in the back of somebody's car, hitching a ride, and ends up at this remote house and is kind of stalking this family. And there's not much more to it than that. Like, the, you know, they're kind of in a – like out in a farmhouse or whatever. So the guy that played the geek or the freak as he's listed is – he's never done anything else except
– You don't say.
Well, this is 1990-ish. His name is Edward Terry, but he wrote and starred in The Children, the 1981 that Vinegar Syndrome also put out.
About the Huggy Kids.
Yes, about the Huggy Kids, yeah.
He directed that.
Who directed it?
He directed it.
Oh, he directed – no, he wrote it,
I think. He wrote it.
Yeah, yeah, let me see. Yeah, writer, The Children.
Huh.
From 1980. So it's just weird to me that this guy's 2 credits were The Children in 1980, and then he starred in Luther the Geek as the main character. But that said, there's actually some kind of – I mean, there's some great gore in this, which is what I remember from Fangoria, because that's his thing, is he puts the teeth in, and then he like goes for the jugular in the neck and just rips it out. And so the practical effects are pretty cool, and Vinegar Syndrome is always – like, this is a gross movie that they made look good. And it's kind of like, I don't know if I want it to look this good because it's really gross. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, it's a guy biting people's necks off that clucks like a chicken.
Yeah.
So it's a good spiritual.
That's fun.
It's fun. If you want to see it with New York Ripper, there's a quacking guy and then you got the plucking
guy.
That's a
double.
And it's short. It's like 80 minutes, so which is my sweet spot.
I remember Mad Mike's video, which was in my town, Wallingford, Connecticut. They had the poster for Luther the Geek up in the window like for a very, very long time, and I was always tempted to watch it, but I just never could find like the time to get my parents away.
This is when he just gets out and goes to the supermarket.
Oh my
god! He's like a very odd character that
you're
like.
Looks just like Spader in the movie you're talking about.
Yeah, that's him and the children, and then this is him and Luther the Geek.
Oh, that actor! Oh,
yeah. That guy, I guess now.
Yeah, now I know.
So it's bizarre. I definitely recommend watching it, especially if like Ryan, you just remember the box. And
yeah.
You're like, oh yeah, it was worth watching, but I don't think it's like. Hmm. It wasn't exactly a gem that I was happy to discover. It was just an interesting watch. So there you have it.
Cool.
Vinegar Syndrome Connection. So this is more of an update than a horror movie. When Vinegar Syndrome were on our show, Joe Rubin said the best movie they have, in his opinion, was a film called Good Luck, Miss Wyckoff. So, of course, I became very interested to see this movie and finally just watched it this week. While not a horror film, it is certainly horrific. It is definitely a holy shit kind of movie. It is about a woman in a small town in Kansas in 1950s. She's kind of probably like a late 30s virgin. It's definitely implied that she's probably never been with a man. She's a school teacher, really good teacher. Everyone loves her, lives in like a little boarding house with another teacher and some very, very well-to-do people. And one day she goes to the doctor, and the doctor, I can't remember his name, but from all the Westerns, he says, oh, you might be going into early menopause. And if you want to, you know, if I was you, you're not using your body. Use it or lose it, sister, because you're not using your body, you might be going into early menopause, and kind of is encouraging to find a lover, even though he's kind of sleazing on her. Then she goes and gets a shrink, and there's no one better if you're going to get a shrink than Donald Pleasance. So she goes to shrink Donald Pleasance and starts telling her, and she's looking for some sort of advice from him, and he's very much not about giving her any. He's like, he keeps saying that it sounds like you're looking for permission to have an affair with that man. It's constantly that kind of psychology. And so her performance is really tortured, and she's really buttoned up. And there's this very attractive African-American – what is he? He's like, I guess, the guy who comes and cleans their classrooms at the end of the night, but he's also like – it's not like traditional cleaners, because he's actually like the high school jock from a different school. So he's like – or at a different college. So he's very attractive, but he's wearing cleaner's clothes. And he basically kind of zeroes in on her one day after school and sexually assaults her in a really fucking scary, like all about power, you know, and using his power over her. And it's really quite – this is one of those films that goes, oh, here's the line of what's polite about making movies, and now I'm going to fucking burn that line and cross it. So – I mean, I couldn't even believe how far this movie pushes things and still was kind of what you would consider a major motion picture in terms of cast and stuff, and it felt like quite a big movie. So that happens, and then what happens is he starts every day after school. He comes and will lock the door and says, you know, I own you. It becomes kind of a – He kind of starts to treat her like a possession and almost like a slave. It's all about power dynamics. Right. And she starts to, over time, I don't want to say she enjoys it, because obviously a lot of it's based on the power structure, but they become more like lovers than it's less violent in a sense, but it's also incredibly taboo, because it's also 1950s white town. And so if anything was to get out and there's some sort of discovery, I don't want to ruin where it goes. It is hard hitting. It's Jesus. Hard to watch. Her performance is utterly fearless.
What,
like the thing
wait,
she does.
What is the name of this movie?
It's called Good Luck, Miss Wyckoff, and it's from 1979. This will be in my discoveries for like Pure Cinema's list, because it's definitely that kind of movie. But I had to bring it up here because it was on our show that Severin said this is Joe's favorite movie that he's put out, and I can see why, because it kind of sums up everything they do, and it feels like that actor's the doctor. What's his name?
Robert Vaughn
plays the doctor, saying you should use it or lose it. It's pretty amazing. But the way people treat her in this film, based on, you know, because she was with a black man, is kind of almost makes it horror noir. It has a little bit of a connection there, because it is so – I think it's actually very realistic the way it portrays how she is received after this, both as a victim of sexual assault and also just because she was with an African-American man in this town. But her performance, it's one of those things like you have given everything you could possibly do in a movie. I thought it was really interesting. Obviously, from my description, it'll be an instant turnoff to many people, and I would not blame you. It is not an easy view. And even the sexual politics between the two is actually quite complex where it pushes to. He is a villain, but some of the stuff they do with him, it's like, oh, it's interesting why he might be acting this way. It's a fascinating movie. Definitely not traditional horror, but you got your Donald Pleasance in there.
Jesus.
Ryan's going to save that one for himself.
So when I worked in the broadcast news business, this is what we call an awkward transition. Yeah. It's like reporting like a multiple car wreck in which a bunch of teenagers died and then going, okay, now to Joe for weather. Yeah. I would love to talk about the mole people from 1956.
I'm kind of offended by this.
It's been some time since I've watched the Mole People, and
I saw you enlisted a lot of graphic designers over the.
I did.
Your Descent comparison.
Super, super excited about it.
I had a Mole People question at trivia on Thursday.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. Yeah, I did too.
The Mole People is a very fun great Saturday afternoon matinee kind of movie from Universal. I remember I had a beloved VHS copy that I wore out really quick, but basically it's about a bunch of archaeologists led by John Agar, and we all love John Agar. Except for maybe Mystery Science Theater. And they discover evidence of a lost Sumerian civilization that was like struck by a great flood, and then the flood drove them into the mountains or underground or something like that. Whatever the case is, it forces the archaeologists underground, where they discover that there is an ancient civilization of mole people, and they are an albino race who have been living for centuries underground, and they have enslaved these mole-like creatures, and they're kind of assholes. And
wait,
so
the albinos or
the albinos?
The mole people?
Okay. Yeah. So the albinos are really they're technically the mole people. Uh-huh. And these poor mole creatures have been enslaved, and they're using them for all sorts of slavery stuff. And it's really mean, and it's really kind of a dick move. And, of course, when John Agar and his, like, topsiders go underground, these albinos are like, kill them! They're basically, because they are – the mole people believe that what their world is real, and if you're not from the heavens, then you're obviously from something else, and you need to be destroyed. So – John Agar breaks out his trusty flashlight, and he's like, I've got the power of the heavens, and he flashes the flashlight in their eyes, and of course, because they got albino skin, and it kind of burns their eyes, and they're like, oh my God, it's true, you are from the heavens. So John Agar and his guys, they lead this little ruse for a little while, and they discover a non-albino civilian that is living underground, and she's just this gorgeous actress. And of course, John Agar comes on to her immediately in that classic Universal 1950s way.
You're a woman.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah. He's like, you're a woman. So you should be coming. You should be coming with me. And the albino race discovers that these guys are not from the heavens and they're not gods. And of course, they try to kill our heroes, but our heroes use the mole creatures to fight back. And there's like a big Spartacus-like uprising of the mole creatures, and there's a big fight, and our guys get to topside.
But what happens? Do they just leave everything? Like, well, we created a hellish environment down there.
Absolutely, yes.
It went from total order to total chaos.
Total chaos, and they bring.
But fuck that! Just close the gate.
They bring the girl who, I mean, like you guys, you could skip ahead 30 seconds if you want. No spoilers on the mole people, but they bring the girl topside. And they're like, wait till you're acclimated to our world. It's beautiful. There's technology. There's all these things. And she's like, okay, great. And then all of a sudden there's an earthquake and it freaks her out. And she goes, tries to go running back towards the gate to the underground civilization. And a pillar falls on her and she dies.
What?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And that's how the movie ends.
Oh, Jesus.
So.
Well, I mean, technically she had been abducted by a group of captors, one of whom was sexually assaulting her. So I think.
That is very true, Becca. Yes, that is very,
what a joy.
She preferred death than to be dominated by John Agar.
Those last two sound like one hell of a double feature.
Yeah.
Those last two films, I'm telling you.
But, you know, the mole people is really interesting because there's some really interesting – obviously there's, you know, really questionable depictions of slavery and then there's also some graphic – there's some really graphic stuff in the film where they sacrifice three women to the sunlight and they bring out their charred corpses. And it's like pretty – in terms of Universal monster oeuvre, it's very graphic. And thankfully they kind of go into that on the special features on this disc that were released from Shout Factory. There's a great making of that talks about – the money-saving tools that they use, because this film relies a lot on stock footage. You're like, Jesus Christ, it's like 10 minutes of stock footage of them climbing a fucking mountain. It goes into how Universal was using contract players, reusing some of the monster bits, like the hands of the mole people, mole creatures were used in another film. And they talk about the censor issues. You know, at the time in 1956, the censors took issue with these charred corpses coming out, you know. So it was really cool. I mean, it's a pretty solid disc presented by Shout Factory. The Mystery Science Theater 3000 episode is there in its entirety. Mm-hmm. And it was funny because I wound up watching The Mole People. It's short. It's a brisk 90 minutes. And I started watching Mystery Science Theater and I was just like in tears because those guys savaged this movie so bad. It's so fucking funny. So anyways, it's again, fun Saturday matinee movie, The Mole People.
The Mole People. Okay, well, I will jump into Good Neighbors from 2011, which I saw on Shudder, which I knew nothing about. It was completely a blind watch based on the you might like, based on prior watches you might like. And this was the very first one that popped up. And so I was like, okay, I've never seen this or heard of this. I'm in. From 2011, directed by Jacob Tierney, who had not directed much else stuff that I was familiar with, but he was in Pin. He was the kid from Pin.
Huh.
So that made me perk up a good bit. So the movie is set in Montreal in 1995 in the middle of this like very volatile election that's going on, where it's like two parties going back and forth and there seems to be a lot of tension between it, and everybody's kind of like picking a side. But at the same time, there's this we don't talk about politics because it's just going to make us hate each other. It feels very much like our current political climate. So this is going on in Montreal in 1995. The entire thing takes place basically in one apartment building. And it's a group of mostly single people, at least the ones that we're exposed to, who live in this apartment building. And we know that there is a killer on the loose somewhere in the city. There's a serial killer on the loose in this city. And you get the idea really quickly that it's one of these people in this apartment building. Mm. Everyone who lives in this apartment building, the story focuses on two guys and one girl. They are all incredibly socially awkward, but at the same time all want to bang each other. So it feels kind of like Shallow Grave, if you guys remember that one.
Yeah, I love Shallow Grave.
It's not like Shallow Grave was like transcendent for me. This is not quite that level of like transcendence, but it does have that same kind of vibe of like a group of people who are forced to be together, feel like they need to hang out together. They all really want to have sex with each other, but there's a lot of weird stuff going on too. And they all don't like the girl seems to connect to the guy's cat more than actually either of them.
When you got Scott Speedman.
I mean, Scott Speedman. He was who is an invalid in it. He's in a wheelchair.
Scott Speedman. No way, really?
This guy?
Yeah,
he's Underworld. In a wheelchair. Yeah. He's in a wheelchair, which is crazy because he's crazy built, too.
Wow.
So, but yeah, so it's got some clunky moments. But that said, I had fun with it. There was definitely like a mystery going throughout it. The problem that I had with it is none of the protagonists, and the girl ends up kind of being the protagonist that you're with most of the time, none of them are that likable of people. And so there's not the one person that you're like, yes, I can relate to you, Todd. I'm going to stick with you through the whole movie. So the whole time you're kind of like, oh, well, you're our protagonist. Why'd you do that? Don't do that. Don't be like that. And so I found it frustrating just because none of them had very good personalities. But that said, it was definitely an interesting mystery. Very low budget. Don't go in expecting this to be like some lost studio film that you haven't seen. But yeah, it was a fun little discovery. I had a good time with it.
Cool.
So that was Good Neighbors from 2011.
Good Neighbors.
All right. Really quick mention. It's not really a review, but basically so I love the podcast Just the Discs, which is Brian Sauer, your Elric's co-host on Pure Cinema. And I occasionally chime in once a month on that too. But he did a great episode with Brendan Small, who was on our show. And they did a double feature of Cobra, which Shout Factory just put out with Scream Factory, and 10 to Midnight, the Bronson movie.
Perfect double.
And if you first of all, those movies rule, and I have to do that double feature. Second of all, you have to listen to this because anytime Brendan is on Just a Disc with Brian, I guess he just has his keyboard handy because he always does music cues. And basically every couple of minutes, Brennan will hit the synth sound, which I call the cannon sound. It's just like, and then he goes into like Stallone voice. Like,
nice.
Yeah. So anyway, that episode was great. But what it inspired me to do, we've already talked about 10 to Midnight a lot on this show. It's a Golden Globus movie with Charles Bronson going after a serial killer who basically runs around. Is it Los Angeles or New York?
It's L.A.
It's L.A. Runs around New York, stark naked.
Mm-hmm.
And basically he's kind of cult from a little bit Ted Bundy, Richard Speck. It's a little bit of all of them mixed together. And I've seen this movie before. We've loved it. We've talked about it. But there's a commentary on the new Scream Factory release that they were raving about. And I feel bad because I've heard of this guy before and I've started his commentaries. I was like, I'm not in the mood for this. His name is Paul Talbot. And he's this amazing Bronson expert from like Boston. So he's got the thickest Boston accent ever. And not only that, his commentary for 10 to Midnight is wall-to-wall information, but like in the best possible way. So it's just like he's Charles Bronson in L.A., and actually a person this was in one episode of Outer Limits back in so-and-so. He like literally knows every detail of every actor, every set that shows up. It's just incredible. And so it's thoroughly entertaining. Watch listen to the commentary by Paul Talbot. I went and bought his book immediately
because
Bronson's Loose, The Making of the Death Wish Films. And he wrote that book because he's like, basically he's obsessed with Bronson. He watched the first movie and he's like, Death Wish is a masterpiece. And Michael Winner directed the sequels. What happened? Like, how do you go from a movie that's a masterpiece that just goes crazy? And so he got on the phone with Michael Winner, got a great interview with him, and basically that spawned this book.
He's wrong. Each one gets better.
Well, Michael Winner thinks that Death Wish 3 is a comedy, which makes a lot of sense now. But anyway, this guy, Paul Talbot, does all these Bronson commentaries. He did 10 to Midnight, Death Wish 2, which Scream Factory also put out. And I think there's a new one called Breakout, which is an indicator disc of Bronson. Mm-hmm. But I just love this guy and his books. And if you have a Bronson movie, definitely, especially 10 of Midnight, watch it with that. So there you go.
All right.
I have two more.
Okay, I'll just do this one real quick. So I watched Salo.
Again.
I was just trying to find something even darker, more depraved. You go. You're up.
Like the same people?
Well, this one is kind of like my save the best for last. I watched Next of Kin.
Oh, yeah.
From 1982, because Severin sent me a really fancy, gorgeous Blu-ray. And I'd been, and Helric kept telling me not to watch it. I'd had this bootleg.
You had the DVD.
And it wasn't even the real DVD. I had like a burn DVD of Next of Kin that I'd had sitting on my to-watch shelf for a long time. And Elric kept going, don't watch this one. It's not worth it. Just wait till a good release happens or they play it theatrically somewhere. And so I got the fancy blue from Severin. So I dove in. This movie is fucking amazing.
Yeah, it's so good.
Like, I can't believe that this has not gotten more attention over the years. If not for anything. I mean, like, the plot is awesome. But the cinematography on this thing is just epic. It's shot like a giallo film. But really, really good. Not saying that giallo films are bad, but this was really good.
And the fun part is he had no influence, no horror influences really. And so he's funny because you watch it and you go, oh, clearly he's watched Deep Red. Like you just feel it.
It feels
like
Deep Red.
He has never heard of any of that. What he watched was things like Bergman and Antonioni. Right. So he was trying to make this high-end European art film in Australia where no one had watched that shit. Well, and so that he was an outsider.
Get that. I can feel it. Yeah. When I was watching it, what I kept feeling was, oh my God, this guy has seen so much Deep Red. Mm-hmm. He's seen so much like Strip Nude for Your Killer, just any of the, or not Strip Nude for Your Killer, Your Vice is a Locked Door. Mm-hmm. Just all of these like really kind of Euro trashy like murder mystery killer movies. And it's just phenomenal. There's a good bit of nightmare logic that happens within it in the scares. There's this wonderful scene. So the whole setup is that a girl, a young girl, has inherited this massive, lavish estate from her mother.
A retirement home.
And it's been closed down, but in order to keep it open, not have to sell it and like pay all the taxes and everything, she has to reopen it as a retirement home. So within a couple of days of her being there, all of these old folks start showing up. all of varying states of cognition. And one of the things that they establish from the get-go is that old folks are creepy. So, like, she'll be up late at night, like, making a sandwich, and there's old man Peterson in his underwear confused about where he is. And so it's kind of like they really use that to their advantage. There is a scene. It's kind of your first big scare in a bathtub, which gets incredibly trippy. So
it's kind of
gorgeous.
A Lynchian, the parts that are death or dreamy. I remember the thing I remember most about this was seeing the VHS trailer when I was a kid, when I was watching other movies, and I would see the teaser, and the teaser for this was just pure the nightmare
stuff. Nightmare
it was
logic,
purely
yeah.
dreamy shots and very weird. So it took me a long time before I actually got to see it, but those sequences are great.
Yeah,
and it's got Wolf Creek as the
Jeff
killer.
Who plays the worst boyfriend ever. Yeah. Literally, she's like, people are dying at my retirement home and someone's trying to kill me. And he's like, whatever, love, you're fine.
Oh, come on, Sheila.
That's it. And that's literally like pat on the back. And that's his compassion, and no one believes her. But yeah, that's the gist of it, is people start dying. She gets the idea that, like, she keeps seeing someone follow her around. She knows that someone's, like, been in her room. But the people who work there, there's kind of, like, this creepy – there's a groundskeeper, and then there's this woman who's been there forever that's kind of, like, one of the helpers, keep insisting, nothing's wrong. But then she finds her mom's diary, and her mom was kind of going through the same thing where people started dying and disappearing. And so she gets that something's going on. But yeah, and then it gets all nightmare logic-y. It's got some slow parts. Like the first 20 minutes, I was like, oh, just come on, get with it now. But at the same time, the cinematography was so gorgeous during that that
It goes utterly batshit by the end.
Yeah.
And like,
oh,
in
my
terms
God,
of
yeah.
action sequences at the end. So it really goes somewhere.
Yeah, first act was a bit slow, but beautiful. And then as soon as it went somewhere, I was like all in. I was like, this is
I think
is
my
crazy.
Favorite shot of the year of seeing, like, the, you know, seeing on Blu-ray was the thing with the sugar cubes at the end. She's stacking these sugar cubes into
such
perfect
a cool moment
triangle, and then something happens, but I won't tell you. But it's like, I don't want to overhype it to people, because it's one of those little gems that when you watch and go, oh shit, this is great. But it's cool that I watched it a couple months ago, because of the Umbrella disc, which is region free,
yeah,
which is, so you can watch that one too. But Severin now have put it out, so you know, I'll be curious if they did any different extras.
Yeah.
Or
I think there are different extras on it, but I haven't had a chance to really put them side by side.
Yeah, I mean, this definitely is arty. It's not going to be for everybody, because it does have a lot of slow-moving, just beautiful, aesthetical shots. I don't know if aesthetical is a word, but I'm using it.
It is now.
So, yeah, but that is Next of Kin, highly recommended. And that is from 1982, directed by Tony Williams. And the last
Who is a New Zealander, not an Australian? And to end, Becca gave it 4 stars.
4 stars. You do stalk me on Letterboxd, dude.
I did know that.
You did. I did give it 4 stars. And like I said, I do not give my 4 stars out
so
to just
there you
anybody.
Go. So today's wow. proven. Our record, you know, it's proving
yeah.
what you're saying.
Okay,
and
all right.
Okay, so then the last thing that I will quickly plug is a damn good book, which I am not done, so you may not borrow it yet, but I am 2/3 of the way through, and it is just completely blowing me away. Her Body and Other Parties.
That's only like 10 pages in.
What are you talking about?
Oh, stop teasing.
No, that's like my first one, dude. So what that is the story that I want to make into a film that made me go, I wonder who has the rights. It's already sold. But that said, it is amazing. Her Body and Other Parties by Carmen Maria Machado. I hope I'm saying that correctly. It is a series of ghost stories. It's a series. Well, some of them are ghosts. Some of them are more murder mystery. All very female oriented. I won't call them feminist, because I know that'll turn off a crop of our listeners. But I will call it female oriented. So they all have female protagonists. They deal with female issues. Not even so much. Some of them are just straight horror stories that have a female protagonist. But they're all really phantasmagoric, I'll use that. Really dreamy, and get just really trippy and weird. So I have absolutely loved this. It's really cerebral, and I'm having a blast with it. So yeah, Her Body and Other Parties.
Cool. Well, we have a guest, so let's bring him on right after these messages. Today's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Diabolik DVD, featuring demented discs from all over the world. Check them out online at www.diabolikdvd.com. They are the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from all around the world. If you are looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head over to Diabolik DVD. Right now, over at the website, you will find all the latest releases from Severin Films, including Next of Kin, Invasion of the Blood Farmers, and Skinner. They have the new 4K restorations of Fulci's Zombie from Blue Underground. They also have the 3-disc limited edition of Maniac from Blue Underground. They also have Porno Holocaust, now available on Blu-ray for the first time ever. Again, that's Porno Holocaust. So for all of your horror and cult cinema needs, head on over to DiabolicDVD.com or find them on Facebook.
Excuse me, do you happen to have Porno Holocaust? Why, yes, we do. Tonight's Shockwaves is also brought to you by Shudder. AMC Network Shudder is a premium streaming video service, super serving fans of all degrees with the best selection of horror and thrillers. Shudder's irrepressible and thriving community revels in all things provocative, evocative, and dangerous. From bantering with Shudder on social media and contributing fantastic, irreverent reviews to relishing in member-only perks such as exclusive releases and VIP movie screenings, Shudder believes there is safety in numbers. Don't be left in the dark alone. You can stream great thrillers, horror, and suspense for $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year. Shudder has the largest, fastest-growing human-curated selection of thrilling and dangerous entertainment. I'd go further than just saying human-curated. It is curated by real horror fans and some of the best in the biz. It has been called the Netflix of horror, and it right now has The Reflecting Skin, which is a favorite of mine and super hard to get
such
up until now.
Movie.
So very happy about that. To try Shudder free for 30 days, go to Shudder.com /podcast and use promo code WAVE. That's Porno Holocaust. No, sorry.
Fangoria turns 40 this year, and issue 2 is out to subscribers now. It's 100 pages of exclusive, carefully curated horror content honoring horror's past, present, and future. Fangoria is also getting into music. Holly Doom is a collection of synthwave scores from artists like John Carpenter, Power Glove, Gunship, and more. Holly Doom is now available wherever you download music. Fango's book line continues. Joining Preston Fassel's Our Lady of the Inferno is Max Booth III's Carnivorous Lunar Activities. It's a bloody romp about the dilemma of what to do when you discover your childhood BFF is a werewolf. Relatable. Carnivorous Lunar Activities is available for pre-order. Head to Fangoria.com now to learn more and subscribe. Subscribe today and get issue 3 shipping in April. $60 gets you a year subscription and saves you about $20 off the cover price. Fangoria.com.
All right, with that tear of the paper, we are back. It is a few weeks after Valentine's Day, but
doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Still celebrating.
We are still
feeling the love, guys.
Still feeling the love in my heart for not just my significant other, but for the film that this man in the house directed, George Mihalka, director of My Bloody Valentine, the original.
That's right.
My Bloody Valentine.
Yeah.
George, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here, man.
Thank
where
you
are you,
so
where
much.
Are you, where are you hailing from? Where are you in from right now?
I'm in from Budapest.
Budapest. Oh, wow. What are you doing in Budapest?
Yeah.
Preparing for a miniseries that I'll be shooting over there for the next year.
Nice.
Is wow. it a Canadian miniseries or is this like
it's European.
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 Okay.
Miniseries.
Very cool. Is it genre or is this something different?
It's sort of the Hungarian version of Game of Thrones.
Oh, very cool. Ooh.
Based on a actual historic character. Hmm. You know, one of the big heroes of Hungary,
nice.
Who in the 14th century prevented the Ottoman Empire from taking over Europe for a while.
That's cool. Yeah. Now, how do you crew up over there? I'm always so intrigued when people tell me that they're shooting in Budapest, which is incredibly
you
common.
Just tap into Bellatar films.
Exactly. Yeah.
All long takes, right? That's all they're used to.
Yeah. No, it's easy. And I mean, they've got excellent crews. They've got superb crews, superb studios. You know, everything we got here, they got there.
A shocking number of horror films are made there. So, yeah.
Including Tom Cruise's last one.
Yeah.
Well, we don't talk about that. but we will talk about a little bit about your past, George. Now, George, I mean, like, you know, our listeners are giant fans of My Bloody Valentine. And, you know, when we roll around to February 14th, does it ever get boring for you when the fans reach out and everybody's like, oh, it's that time you start looking on social media and there's memes of My Bloody Valentine and you see Harry Warden out there? Does it ever get tiring or are you just like, this is fantastic?
It's the second. It is fantastic. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's one of those things where when I first made the film, and because of the fact that it was, I guess, deballed would be the best way to speak about it, I kind of forgot about it.
Yeah.
And then a few years later, the love just started to grow. Mm-hmm. And it just keeps growing. And as a matter of fact, it grows every year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it just astounds me. And it's the best compliment a filmmaker can get.
No, yeah. I imagine. Oh, I was going to say, sorry, Becca.
Oh, I was just going to say, you had your own T-shirt line this year.
Oh, yeah.
Which I loved.
Fright Rex did a little bit of stuff. But, but I imagine that it really kind of kicked into gear when Lionsgate put out that DVD release, which was like a big special edition. Would you say that that was kind of like a... it grabbed a whole new generation and a new audience with that?
I think the beginning of it was when that fabulous art punk band named themselves after the movie.
Yeah.
That kind of started the whole new process,
the new awareness,
yeah. the new fans. Then the Lionsgate release didn't hurt, you know, and then the reviews of the original compared to the remake didn't hurt at all.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, and since then it's been just an upward swing. It's been amazing, actually. Yeah.
And you and I meet at Fantasia seemingly almost every year, and you've been around the convention scene. What are the fans responding to? When you're on the ground speaking to them, what are they responding to? Is it the pure slasher vibe? Is it the Canadian voice to it? Because I respond to a lot of things about this movie, and there's just so much charm and character to it.
Well, you know, it's actually funny because most of the fans don't respond really to the slasher vibe.
Mm.
They respond to the characters. They respond to the atmosphere.
Yeah.
They respond to the whodunit.
Yeah.
They respond to the that mystery which was built in, where it's not about the murders. It's about the people.
Yeah.
I like the blue collar beer drinking.
Yeah,
and it's them sitting around drinking beers, and you're just laughing.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing because when I was making it, my favorite movie at the time when I was making it was The Deer Hunter.
Oh, yeah.
I actually feel that. That somehow makes sense.
And somehow or other, Rodney Gibbons, the director of photography and I, just kept saying, you know, if we can sneak it in, let's make this The Deer Hunter of horror movies.
That's cool. And
I think in a way, that's what still resonates. It's the characters.
Yeah.
And I think also the counter casting in a way. You know, the fat guy is actually the most respected and the leader of the group.
Right.
And he's got the hottest babe.
Yeah.
So I tried to do those things with him. And I think over the years, that has actually come through more and more. And people are appreciating it more and more.
Were you steeped in the horror at the time? Like, because this is 81, right? So this is pretty early in any kind of slasher cycle that was to come.
Yeah.
And it never really felt like other slasher films exactly at that time, probably because of where you come. But were you very steeped in horror, or was that something that – was it like a job that you had to research, or were you actually a horror fan to get into that?
I wasn't really a horror fan. My favorite horror movie at the time was the Night of Living Dead. Mm. I accidentally fell into Bloody Valentine. I had a two-picture deal with John Dunning and Andre Link. And the first picture was a comedy I was going to be making because my first movie – this was my second film.
Mm-hmm.
I was 28 years old. Mm. And the first movie was a comedy and it did quite well.
It was Pickup Summer.
That's right. Yeah. You know, and it did extremely well internationally. And obviously for John Dunning and Andre Link, money was the reason why they were making movies.
Sure.
So they always wanted to make some movies that, you know, were commercial successes. So because it was a comedy, I started working on a comedy with some people from the National Lampoon.
Hmm.
And the head writer ended up having a nervous breakdown and delivered an 800-page script.
That's
insane.
Yes, it is. And he was.
That is.
And
like
he was. You know.
Ulysses, yeah. The film
script. So John Dunning said, I'm not going to be able to finish reading this script before we're supposed to be on in the theaters.
Yeah.
So how about if you do your second movie first for me?
Huh.
And he handed me a piece of paper. It was a one-page synopsis of My Bloody Valentine called The Secret.
Yes, that's
right. Yeah. And he said, this is the one. Paramount is interested in doing it. Would you do this? And I said, John, I've never made a horror movie. And he said, well, you never made a comedy before you made one.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, well, if you think I can do it, I'll do it.
Yeah.
And the only problem was, obviously, is that was in end of July.
Yeah.
And he said, well, there's only one little problem. We got to get this into 1,200 theaters by February 13th.
Oh, yeah.
You were like, absolutely.
Yeah, and I said, yeah, I don't need any sleep.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Let's do it.
So that's how it happened.
So yeah, Valentine's Day was still part of it, even though the title wasn't.
Yeah. The reason we called it The Secret is because nobody – John didn't want to give away that we were doing a Valentine's Day thing.
Right.
Because he didn't want to make sure – you know, at the time there was a lot of small companies that would just jump on something like that and do something really quick and cheap.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, I'm sure there was a lot of producerial competition in the slasher arena. You know?
Well, just trying to lay stake on a date or a holiday or whatever. Yeah. It was kind of crazy in that era.
Smart.
Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry. No, the thing I kind of wanted to ask about in terms of the release. So when Lionsgate re-put out the uncut version, which had the extra bits in it. Now, I've always had affinity for this movie, but I still gladly have that out of print Blu-ray, which a lot of people don't anymore. But when you see that movie with the inserts, it's literally like getting the punchline to jokes, you know, like it's there. And, you know, I always liked the movie, but the uncut one puts it like in Friday the 13th territory. Like it should have been as big as that franchise. So, first of all, congrats that it finally got out that version. But what was the general, you know, I know it must have been painful to have to cut snippets out. But what was the general response when it came out? Like obviously I didn't discover it until much later. So was it a hit? Did it do well? Did it do well for you personally and professionally? And was it hard having to put out a version that was slightly not exactly what you wanted it to be?
Very difficult. One of the problems was that we were doing basically the state-of-the-art special effects, practical special effects with Tom Berman. And we invented this stuff that was all going to be done in one take. You know, so in other words, when the pickaxe hit underneath the chin at the same shot, in the same shot, the eyeball would pop out and the tip of the pickaxe would come out. And when the guy got boiled, his face got boiled off, that was a 30-second shot where layers of makeup would boil and bubble and trouble and so on until his face turned into, you know, a cooked piece of meat. The problem was that as the MPAA started asking us for cuts, we couldn't cut because, you know, and they'd say, well, shave off 10 frames or cut to something else. Well, there was nothing else to cut to. So each time, and we were mixing at the same time and negative cutting at the same time as one of our editors was in L.A., with the MPAA. So we basically died the death of 1,000 cuts. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, to the point where, and I spent so much time on the sound on this, that whole breathing thing. I'm actually the I did that over at Burbank Studios. And they actually made us or asked us to do cuts when there was nothing left because the sound was still that impressive.
Wow.
So by the time it came out, the problem was that everyone was expecting to have the bloodiest movie there was. And one of the things I wanted to do with this film is the same way that I try to create a sort of reality and realism with the characters is my violence hurt. It was there to actually rub it in your face a little bit.
Sure.
And so when the film came out, especially called My Bloody Valentine, and, you know, I just sort of said, well, this is my anemic Valentine. There's no red blood cells left in this movie. So the first run didn't do as well as it should have.
Yeah.
1,200 theaters and basically, you know, the marketing got everybody into the theaters, into the seats, bums into the seats in the first week. But afterwards, the actual fans who went for the gore said, well, there's none.
Mm.
It still got some pretty decent reviews, and it still did okay business, but not nearly what it was expecting to do, and not nearly what I expected it to do.
Right.
You know, so.
Were you able to release an unrated at the time in other territories, or did you have to release
no,
the American
unfortunately,
cut?
No, unfortunately, the problem is because all that negative got cut into like 3 frames off, 7 frames off, 8 frames off. There was no way that we could actually put some of that back together again.
Right.
And the outtakes somehow got lost. Mm. That's why when you see the that special edition, those were actually work print,
right?
That
right.
we found that John Dunning found
right.
When he was clearing out his warehouse in some locker.
Mm. Wow!
Yeah. So we're thankful to have that.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's only about I would say 30 to 40% of what was actually the rest is lost. There's a scene that's totally lost. You know, which basically we couldn't even – they didn't even want us to touch.
And what was that?
It's where the two kids who go off and the two virgins and they get impaled together.
Uh-huh.
And basically what happens is he's on top of her and they're kissing and they're making love. And the miner comes behind and puts the awl, that huge, big, giant awl, through his back, which then makes him go, ooh. Which then makes her go, ooh. Which then she opens her eyes and he bleeds into her mouth.
Oh, that's great.
Then he does it again. Yeah. And now, you know, her blood mixes with his blood and it's really – it was beautifully shot. It was done. I did that as sort of like a very romantic, but.
Well, I'm curious. I mean, going back to never having done a horror film, but, My Bloody Valentine and what you're talking about comes with a little bit of gleeful carnage. So for you, where does that come from? I mean, what kind of homework did you do for yourself when you told them, I'll take on this gig? Let me do it. Obviously, with the time frame coming up. But what did you do in preparation for it?
Spent a lot of time with Tom Berman.
Yeah. Mm. Nice. That's great.
Spent a lot of time with Tom Berman. Yeah. Spent a lot of time with John Dunning because John was, a master at that.
Yeah.
And we just sort of worked out and John Baird, the writer.
Yeah.
And that was most of my research. Yeah. There really wasn't anything around. I think Halloween 1 was out,
and
Friday the 13th.
Yeah.
And obviously I watched both of those movies. But what I didn't want to do is do what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried to stay away from anything that they were doing and try to do something a little different.
Yeah.
Which I think if we didn't get censored would have probably have made it into an amazingly, amazingly hot horror film or slasher
Absolutely.
Film.
Absolutely. Well, was Paramount present at all?
None whatsoever. None whatsoever.
So they were just there as an active participant in distribution and getting it out there.
Yeah. I mean, basically the timeline was so fast that there really wasn't any chance for anyone to really get involved.
Yeah.
And we were shooting in this small town in Cape Breton Island, Nova Scotia. Far away from everybody, 900 feet underground, two miles out underneath the ocean.
So you were shooting an actual mine.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was a real mine.
Crazy. How did you get the crews? Like, were there like transports? Because from mining Appalachian area. So did you have like the actual like transports to take everybody down in, or was this like a walkable mine?
No. It was all a transport. It was basically, that train track or that little train.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the ways in, and the other one was the elevator.
Hmm.
And actually, we took the elevator down. So it took 45 minutes to get the crew down in the morning.
So obviously, the crew's not wearing respirators or anything. How were they controlling the air quality down there, or was it like a retired mine?
It was a just recently retired mine. We still got kicked out about 4 times because of methane buildup.
That's fun.
Yeah. Basically, we were wearing the same outfits mm-hmm. that all the miners in the movie wear, and we had we had – well, one of the big problems obviously was when we showed up is when they told us that we can only use 25-watt bulbs.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question is light control, because it is like – until you have been down in a coal mine, guys, you have no idea what darkness is. Yeah. It is blacker than – it is just pure darkness.
Yeah.
And so I can't even imagine having to light that area or getting the gear down.
Well, the gear down was not that bad. The lighting was the big challenge. Mm-hmm. And we ended up using the same lenses that Stanley Kubrick used.
Barry Lyndon. Yeah. Low level.
We had one of the world's first digital light meters because we were working at 1 and 2 foot candles.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my gosh.
And basically all we could use was 25-watt bulbs. The whole movie was shot with 25-watt bulbs and inkies. I don't know if anyone still remembers what an inky is.
Yeah.
You know, and because anything else was unsafe because of the sparking problems.
Jesus.
You know, so
were there any scary moments like that, being in such a claustrophobic space?
Well, I'd say being told that it's filling with methane and everybody has to get out is a little
terrifying. But you got warning on that.
That was about it. You know, the rest of the time, you know, I mean, we were so focused on trying to make this film and trying to make it as good as possible that, you know, I mean, honestly, I could have been in a field of landmines and not cared.
Yeah.
You know.
Where did the one of my favorite things and the things that make it memorable to me is where did the idea of a theme song, the Ballad of Harry Warden, which is a really nice song, but it's so – like for a slasher, I feel like all slashers now should have a song like that, like about the character.
Yeah.
But where did that come from? Because that is really unique.
That was a last-minute thing that happened between Paul Zaza and I, the composer. We were going to rework one of the overtures and place that onto the credits.
Mm.
And when I heard it, I said, you know, it's fine, but there's just something missing. And I don't know what it is, but, you know, maybe a song, maybe something. Mm. Because he wrote all those Westerns and all those songs that are in the film.
Right, right.
And I said, you know, maybe something like that, something that just captures the atmosphere of that blue-collar town rather than the, you know, replaying the or whatever that was, you know?
Yeah.
And he said, you know what, that's a great idea. And he came back 2 days later with it.
Hmm. That's cool.
Wow. 2 days?
Yeah.
That's insane. Well,
2 days was a lot of time in this movie. You know, that was like an eternity.
Jesus.
That's a lot. I mean, that was like a YouTube favorite for many years, like, oh, the Ballad of Harry Warden. And then Waxworks put out that record where it sounds pristine and beautiful, and it's like this amazing ballad.
It actually is a good song.
Yeah, you're like,
it's a really good song.
Yeah.
Well, apparently I heard when Tarantino was shooting Inglourious Bastards, they played that. Him and Eli played that every day.
Oh, wow.
At the end of Rap.
That's pretty fun.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, following up My Belated Valentine in terms of the horror end of things, in 85 you did Eternal Evil, a film I have not seen in forever. But has anybody done a proper release of that?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
I think
one of those VHS only.
Yeah, I think what happened with that is that was the Canadian tax shelter time.
Yeah.
And I think the rights somehow or other got disappeared.
Yeah.
But I just saw that recently.
Oh, really? And how does it hold up?
Amazing.
Really?
Amazing. And especially now because it's all about gender fluidity.
Yeah.
Mm. And, Karen Black plays a man.
Yeah.
Who has taken over the body of a woman who makes love to a man to take over his body, and it's all about it's basically soul vampires.
Yeah.
And it actually held up super. A lot of people are saying the two things that I should do a sequel to are one, Bloody Valentine.
Yeah.
And
Eternal Evil.
Well, which is actually was called The Blue Man.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, the original title, when it won that award in Avoriaz, it won it under The Blue Man.
Interesting.
You know.
Interesting. I'm looking on Amazon Prime, and it's actually on Amazon Prime, apparently. It's
well, I don't know if I would trust the quality of that image.
That's very true.
Yeah, and it's digitally remastered.
Digitally remastered by Mutant Sorority Pictures.
Oh, my.
They're reputable. You'd be surprised. Very reputable.
So take a shot at it. How was it like? What was it like working with Karen? Any fun stories from that?
Really, honestly, she was probably the most professional, laid-back, easygoing person I've worked with.
Yeah.
You know, all the rumors about Karen being crazy, I never felt that for one instant. She came in, did her gig, went home, came in superbly well-prepared, did her next day's work, went home.
Yeah.
Not a problem. Yeah. It was just a wonderful experience.
That's cool. That's cool.
You know.
What were your so Lionsgate starts to get the notion of remaking My Bloody Valentine. When do you first hear about this?
When they called me to approve the new cut of the old Valentine.
Oh. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting timing.
Yeah.
And what was your reaction? What, I mean, did they give you a script or
nothing?
Nothing. They
nothing
just said
at all.
We're thinking about.
No, they said we're doing it.
Oh, we're doing.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Yeah, we're
so
doing
they just
it.
Said.
Matter of fact, yeah. We're in production.
Oh, so they were already pretty far along by that point.
Yeah.
Jesus,
yeah.
That's courteous.
Yeah. Well, no, you know, I mean, look, it is what it is. You know, I mean, they. You know, I look at it this way. You know, since the film industry has started, how many movies have been made? 500,000?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
How many have been remade? A couple of hundred?
Yeah, I'll take that.
I'll take that as a compliment.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, plus you get to be part of a conversation where people probably go, I like the original more. And you get to be that original. So that's
happened a lot.
I believe it. It happens with a lot of good movies.
Well, I actually rather like both. And to me, the test of a remake is if you can do a double feature with the original and the remake and you don't feel like you watch the exact same movie, but they complement each other in a way, then that's kind of a fun remake because then you did a double feature.
Yeah.
But the thing that I've done in recent years, and actually – I think it was with Ryan and Sierra. Mm-hmm. So I'm a huge home 3D buff, and it's one of my favorite 3D titles.
It's an amazing 3D
it
title.
It looks amazing. Yeah. But normally I used to watch the original first, uncut, and then go into 3D one. But I think for whatever reason we swapped it the one time a couple years ago. And I much rather prefer watching the newer one and then going. It's almost like the reward. Like, now let's go back to the original.
Uh-huh.
I don't know why. It just plays more interestingly that way. Maybe it's because there's more likable characters in the original. Because I just revisited it again and it's like it ages interestingly how horrible everybody is.
They feel – everyone is very caricature-y.
Well, they're all cheating on each other.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't have your Deer Hunter note. That's the problem. They weren't trying to make Deer Hunter. That's, you know.
I think that's probably it. You
get those like the wedding sequence, right? That's what you're doing?
Yeah.
But here's the thing. So that movie was very successful and it brought a lot of attention back to the original. And I know the filmmakers behind the remake wanted to do a sequel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those things that it almost seemed like a no-brainer and then it didn't happen. And, you know, did you ever think about a sequel to yours? And, you know, kind of why did Harry Warden not get more movies, I guess?
You know, I'm not quite sure about that. Right now I'm in the process of looking at potentially making a sequel.
To the original.
You know, it's going to be interesting to see, you know, how it goes, but it looks very interesting at the moment. So, I really don't know why, it hasn't happened because Harry Warden is actually such an incredibly iconic character and visually so interesting. I'm kind of surprised, but you know. Hopefully that'll change in the next little while.
I hope so.
But it could have been as simple as those cuts, having heard it at the time, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because usually that's when these franchises we've grown to love, it's because they kept making them in a row.
Yeah.
So if the first one doesn't instantly ignite that, it's hard to come back years later at the time, I think. So,
yeah,
it's interesting. I wish I could see some of those
But, you know, one of the things that's happened is over the years, the the fan base has been so much asking for a sequel. You know, it's again, it's one of those weird things where it comes from the fans. Yeah. It's not coming from anywhere else. The same way that the popularity of the film keeps growing every year. You know, I mean, I was just in New York at the Alamo for a screening for Valentine. And they sold out in a day.
Wow.
You know, and it was that, I don't know if you guys heard about that big ice storm, snowstorm.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that was the day.
Oh.
The theater was full.
Yeah, that wouldn't stop New York.
That doesn't stop you.
Didn't stop anybody from showing up. You know, it was just stunning again. So
that's cool.
So hopefully that's going to be the news that I may be able to tell people in a little while.
That's cool. Yeah.
We need more Harry Warren.
I think so. I think the world needs more Harry
Warren. A couple other titles that, you know, you didn't stray too far from the genre pool. I mean, you did Hostile Takeover, Mindfield. You wrote Mindfield.
Yeah.
The Psychic.
Yeah, The
Psychic. Yeah. I mean, like, in terms of your trajectory, what you wanted to do, just talk about the selection process of the films you wanted to make. I mean, where you had done a slasher and that just kind of gave you the taste of horror and you just wanted to stay in that a little bit?
Actually, no. No, actually, what I did was in between all of those, I did something else, and generally in French.
Just as a palate cleanser?
Yeah. You know, after Bloody Valentine, I did a French comedy called Scandale. Mm-hmm. Then after Blue Man, I went off and did a medieval action adventure William Tell series in France.
Yeah.
Then I came back and I did Office Party, which is I don't know what they call it here. Okay. It's the one you just mentioned.
Hostile Takeover. Yeah.
But that was more of a weird psychological genre piece.
Right.
That was about, you know, the meek and mild accountant who takes everybody hostage for no reason.
The poster says, "A man on the edge that has nothing to lose."
That was nothing to do with the film. You know? It was actually much more a theater of the absurd.
Yeah,
wow. You know? That's a damn good poster.
You know? Yeah, but yeah, it has David Warner and Michael Ironside. And a great cast.
You worked with Ironside a couple times too.
Yeah. Well, Ironside and I have been old friends from before we ever worked together.
Oh,
we used to live about four houses from each other for a while in Toronto. So
that's great.
We hung out a lot.
Yeah. He's got to be probably our most honest interviewer.
He came on the show.
He was a lot of fun.
He was just terrific.
He's great.
He doesn't hold back on any
story.
He'll give it to you like that.
Yeah. You know, so, and then again, you know, then I would do something else. Then I did a very big French Canadian hit called La Florida. Mm-hmm. Then I would go and do a genre piece.
Yeah.
Then I go back to do something else in French. Yeah. You know, so it was always something. You know, I love making movies, and I love making movies of all genres, and I love comedy.
Yeah.
And so it was just always a combination of something fun, and then I'd do something a little weird.
Mm-hmm. That's all right. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice.
That's cool. So I mean, obviously, this new project, I mean, that's going to take you into some interesting new territory as well.
Yeah. It's going to be quite interesting.
I think the first time we met was a couple of years back at Fantasia. How important is it for you to be part of the genre scene and staying? You seem to have your finger on the pulse, and every time I go to the Fantasia Film Festival, you're surrounded by young filmmakers asking for your advice. Do you impart a little advice? I heard you go to you are at a couple colleges too, or is that, am I wrong on that?
No. Actually, what I've been doing for the last few years, just to I guess give back a little bit,
is
I teach an advanced graduate program in film directing.
Yeah.
And so I love mentoring younger filmmakers.
Right.
Before I became a filmmaker, I was a teacher. So, and now with, you know, I've sort of come back to my roots a little bit. As a matter of fact, funnily enough, I'm going to be executive producing a horror film called Don't Click.
Okay.
That was a young South Korean woman who was in my class 2 years ago did a four-minute little movie, and little horror movie. And I thought it was really good. So I said, you know, why don't we try to get into a couple of festivals? And in the process, let's see where, you know, it might help your career. And I've got a little bit of street cred with the horror film festival crowd. So maybe we can, you know, it might work.
Yeah.
So 30 festivals later and a bunch of awards later, I spoke with a friend of mine and fabulous producer called Bill Marks. And I said, you know, Bill, we should try and get an option on this and see if we can make it. Well, on Monday, I start prep.
Oh, that's great.
As executive producer on this little horror film that we're doing.
That's cool. So, that's very cool.
And wow. So it's like an extension of the short?
Of the short. And a young woman called Courtney McAllister and Jihei Kim is the director. Mm-hmm. They came up with a fabulous storyline, and we developed it into a feature film script. And Bill Marks is producing it and financing it.
Nice.
And I'm the executive producer on it and sort of mentor.
That's cool.
You know, that's the new thing. That's what I'm going back home for.
I love that.
Is it possible to see Don't Click the Short online anywhere or anything? Has it been released officially?
It probably is. You know, I mean, I wouldn't know, but, you know, I think so. Hmm. Bill might be able to tell us that.
Okay. It's on YouTube. Nice.
There
we go.
YouTube.
Excellent.
Yeah.
We'll share the link to that.
Yeah.
You know.
G.A. Kim.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Cool.
Young man watches a snuff film sent to his email. When the film stops halfway through, he has the option to continue to find out what happens next. All he has to do is click.
Don't click.
That's it.
Click on the YouTube.
Watch the short. Yeah.
Well, George, it's been a pleasure having you on, man. Yeah.
Thank you so much for having us.
This is fantastic. Again, My Bloody Valentine.
One of my favorite voices on the show, by the way.
Yeah, I know.
Yes.
So
put our
soothing.
Hands on.
Good voice.
Like, wow.
So
great
soothing.
Voice.
So soothing.
Well, I will try and keep that up.
we have a brief pause, but then we record the show again in French. So just brace yourself. We're going to do this.
Pas de problème, monsieur.
Oui.
Wow. I'm out. Mark, wow. Out. All right, guys. Thanks for tuning in. Stay tuned next week.
Yep. Thank you.